mix, what I like, what I like, what I like, what I like.
What's up, world, and welcome to another edition of I Mix What I Like, imixwhatilike.org, at I Mix What I Like for all your relevant social media. Again, I'm Jared Ball. I wanted to do a quick podcast in response to something I saw on Twitter last night, but that is also potentially part of something that I and others might revisit as a larger project, because it certainly deserves much more elaboration than I'm going to offer right now. But in the recent upheaval caused by my colleague at Morgan State University, Dr. Jason Johnson, and his comments about Black women supporting Bernie Sanders is coming from the island of misfit girls or something to that extent, I saw a response defending him from Jelani Cobb. And Cobb's defense of Johnson read something to the effect that Johnson should be given credit for working in an urban setting in Baltimore, Maryland, among oppressed and underserved Black people and students, that something along the lines that he and others could make much more money at PWIs, but choose to stay at HBCUs out of some sort of dedication to the people and the struggle. And what it made me think again about is something, again, that I've been thinking about for a long time and wanting to explore more deeply and may indeed do so again at some point, along with maybe some others, or maybe in a variety of different ways. But it's regarding the popular conception of the historically Black college and university among primarily, of course, Black people, many of whom, and I'm not saying this is specific to Cobb or Johnson, I'm just sort of riffing off of that little exchange. There's this misconception of HBCUs among many Black people, of course, who've never either gone there as a student or worked there as a faculty member, that I think, at least for certain those of us of a certain age, has a lot more to do with the fantasies evolved out of the TV show A Different World than anything to do with the actual reality or experience of those on these campuses. I think also it has a lot to do, of course, with the popular suggestion in discussions of HBCUs that they have historically been there to support the development and advance, and in some cases even the radicalism of Black communities in this country, and have been largely an advocate for progressive and advancement for Black people in this country. And while, of course, there is truth to that, and while, of course, there have been many great women and men to come through HBCUs and do great work at HBCUs and who do great work now at HBCUs, it is also misrepresentative to suggest that that's all that occurs in these spaces, and that there aren't conservative and reactionary strands and politics that pervade and even dominate the institutional leadership of HBCUs. Or that there isn't a neo-colonial relationship between HBCUs and the country itself through philanthropy, direct federal funding, or private corporate investment that could be argued and has been in some ways by a variety of folks in different iterations to limit and constrain potential radicalism on these campuses. Shout out to Professor John Bracey for mentioning this at our tribute to Dr. James Turner at the Africana Studies and Research Center about 2 years ago now, who mentioned this book by William Corson, Promise or Peril, The Black College Student in America, which is written by a white man from the perspective of someone surveilling Black students for the state, regarding concern or over concern that Black students might become too radical and potentially participate in, at the time in the 60s and 70s, the most radical elements of Black liberation struggles. My point in bringing that up is whether we go back historically and look at the work of William Watkins and the white architects of Black universities or many other people's work historically, Donald Spivey is another one that comes to mind. We know that there's been a long tradition of white supremacists and capitalists development and influence over these institutions with the idea of creating a black laboring class that would, in nominal freedom, act as you know, much as the enslaved acted relative to an economy based on enslavement in a post-enslavement world. And we see that in Corson's book, there was a concern, you know, a need to or felt at least a concern for national security over what direction black universities were going or in terms of the kinds of students that they were producing. As we've covered at MX What I Like, we've talked with Dr. Jelani Favors about his new book and some of the research he includes, which talks some about the influence of funding going from the liberal arts into STEM related areas as a specific way of limiting critical thought and the potential for radical theories to be developed and taught and expressed and to take hold. And then there is also the reality that again we would likely have to come back to at another time of faculty who get away with things at HBCUs that they couldn't get away with at other universities, and that they're not there because they have a particular concern for black people, but they're there because they've been hooked up with cushy positions where they're paid, in some cases, exorbitant salaries to do very little work related to the students on campus, and who are there for promotional purposes, PR purposes, hooked up by family and friends. Maybe because they raise money through grants, et cetera, but in terms of their ability to impact the students or impact the local communities or certainly to advance critical thought and radical politics, that's not what they're doing. A lot of black professors leave HBCUs because they're tired of having 4-4 schedules imposed on them for lower salaries. And are chastised for going to PWIs to teach fewer classes for more money. But a lot of people, particularly those not familiar with the profession, are not aware of just how taxing and tiring teaching 4-4s for 14 years, like some of us have, for instance, can be. Not everybody's academic experience as a professor is the same, and it doesn't always have anything to do with the quality of their work or the levels of their production. In fact, in some cases, it's quite the opposite, that the lowest producing, least involved, engaged, and least radical and critically thinking faculty are the most heavily promoted and supported. So anyway, I just wanted to put a little bit of that out. And it is something that I've been thinking a lot about and how to address this publicly, because it's certainly not my intent to disparage HBCUs, certainly not to suggest that HBCUs are somehow worse than any other institution in the country. But it is to suggest that a lot of the popular conception, even among academics in some cases who may not have direct familiarity with all of the kinds of experiences that faculty and students have at HBCUs, carries the day. And there are these myths, again, that HBCUs are more radical than they are, and that they support radicalism more than they do, or that all the faculty who are there are really there because they want to work with black students, when in fact, and often, more often than I think we would want to admit or discuss or hope would be the case, is that that's not why they're there. And many of them are just getting very cushy paychecks for doing the kind of work that we wouldn't accept were they white, and that we wouldn't want to promote to anyone looking to advance a sort of critical consciousness among students. So anyway, we'll come back to that again. I'm Jared Ball. This is I Mix What I Like. And as we often say, to you, we say peace if you're willing to fight for it, as did Fred Hampton. And we'll catch you with the next episode. Peace, everybody.
I mix what I like, what I like, what I like, what I like, what I like.